Good afternoon and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. In addition to our guests who are here in the building today, I'd like to especially welcome people really all over the world who watch our programs live via webcast. And also today's presentation is being broadcast by C-SPAN Radio, which of course has national reach. So we're glad to welcome additional viewers and listeners. On November 21st, 2005, The New Yorker published a long article titled Fugitives, Young Iranians Confront the Collapse of the Reform Movement. The article, a copy of which we placed on everyone's seat in the room here today, focused on the experiences of Ruzbah Mirabrahimi, a young Iranian journalist who started a blog to circumvent state censors. In 2004, he was imprisoned for 2 months. He was held in a tiny cell. He was interrogated almost daily, and he was beaten before he was released. I was so interested in the story of how young people were leading resistance to the clerical government and the similarities between the story of the young Iranians and the story of young American freedom riders here in the 1960s, that I invited the author of the New Yorker article to come here to present a forum. Laura Secor spoke here in February of 2006 about Ruzbah Mirabrahimi. Her forum is archived on our website and is well worth watching if you haven't already seen it. So imagine my surprise when several months ago, Laura Secor telephoned me to tell me that Ruzbah had left Iran and was in Brooklyn, staying with his wife in the house Laura Secor shares with her husband, New Yorker writer and Miller Center speaker, George Packer. It did not take me 5 minutes to issue an invitation to Ruzbah to come here to speak and tell his own story. Ruzbah speaks little English, although after lunch today I concluded that his English is much better than my Persian. Fortunately, Professor R.K. Ramazzini, who held the Edward Stettinius Chair and served as chairman of the Woodrow Wilson Politics Department, is a good friend of the Miller Center, and he graciously and generously offered to assist. And he was able to enlist the aid of the distinguished professor of Asian and Middle Eastern languages and culture, Dr. Milani. So today we are triply blessed. Professor Ramazzani, who has written for many years about the Middle East and who has served as a consultant to the White House, the Department of State, the Defense Department, and the Department of the Treasury, will open our conversation this afternoon with comments about contemporary Iran to frame the context for our discussion. He will provide an introduction of Ruzbah Mirabrahimi. And then rather than take the time to listen to Ruzbah's beautiful Persian, which I did at lunch, followed by Professor Ramazzani's translation and Professor Milani's translation, we've decided it would be more efficient for me to read a translation of Ruzbah's planned remarks. The translation was prepared by Dr. Ramazzani and Dr. Milani based on email back and forth between them over the past few days. I am very grateful for their splendid help. Following my reading of the translation, I'll ask the audience for questions. Those questions may be directed to Ruzbah, those questions will then be translated by Drs. Ramazzani and Milani, who will then translate Ruzbah's answers from Persian. I will ask those who have questions to meet me in the back of the room at the appropriate time. So please join me in welcoming Dr. R.K. Ramazzani.
Thank you, George. Gracious and generous in your remarks. And I understood when George first talked to me that I would perhaps provide some kind of a context. And I think context is of greatest importance. Because sound bites, headlines, got us to the point that one of the things that first people wondered about Iran is it Ahmadinejad? that is the depiction of the country, the culture, the history, becomes focus on one man, definitely depicted as the villain. But that's not the way to really try to provide a context. I cannot provide an adequate context within a matter of minutes. In fact, it would need maybe a few seminars to provide a context for what is going on in Iran today. But let me broadly point out, make 3 points. One, the context of what is going on in Iran today is, in a sense, continuity of a context of the Middle Ages, when for the first time the Muslim thinkers, scholars, encountered the West in the sense of the Greek thoughts and ideas. At that time, there were these two major, so to speak, schools of thought, the Ash'ariyya and the Mu'tazili, what nowadays we would call the conservatives and the reformists. It was there in the Middle Ages, in the encounter of the West. The second point, and before I go to the second point, the same thing happened in especially 19th century when modernity, Western modernity, came to the Middle East in general. And at that time, again, you found thinkers, Islamic thinkers, who were thinking about, for example, of compatibility of science and Islam, or democracy and Islam, and progress and Islam. One of the 19th century Persian observers tried to prove that the tenets of Islamic thought, religion, ideas, are not incompatible with what nowadays we call human rights, and he was in effect referring to the French Declaration of Rights of Man, citizens. So this has been an ongoing dynamics in the Muslim world, and it takes a lot of thinking. But in the 20th century, we also came to have what nowadays we label as radicals, militants, conservatives, especially starting in Egypt by a writer thinker who, by the way, came to the United States and went back and was more critical of the West than ever, Sayyid Qutb, and so on. And some people try to relate Osama bin Laden today to Sayyid Qutb of Egypt of the 1940s. Again, we have always had this dichotomy between the interpreters of Islamic tenets in a way that would be reformist in orientation, rethinking, and those who were actually sticking to the tradition strictly and considered reactionary or conservative. Now, the second point I want to make is about the Iranian Revolution. Again, at the level of generality, to be sure, but fundamental to the understanding of the context. The revolution had nationalist, liberal, communist, Islamist, all kinds of factions came together to constitute the Iranian Revolution against the Shah's regime. But some of the most fundamental problems were left and in fact codified in the Iranian constitution. On the one hand, their reactionary emphasis came in what is called in the Iranian context of the rule of the jurisprudence, or fagih, in the Constitution. And on the other hand, kind of a democratic elements, in the sense that the president has to be elected, the parliament has to be elected, councils have to be elected, and so on. So there has been, from a Western perspective, this enormous contradiction, paradoxical problem. And it is a paradoxical one, because this is the essence of the struggle today between the reformists in Iran and the traditionalists or conservatives. This has been the legacy of the revolution. And the third point I would like to make is about the reformist movement. Until 1997, when President Khatami was elected president, and it was a big surprise election, because the supporters of the establishment and those who had establishment candidate didn't win. And President Khatami, in essence, was a major catalyst in opening discussions and the flourishing founding of newspapers. And not Khatami per se as a thinker as such. I brought him down here to the Monticello Foundation for a seminar, because he's a person who has beaten his chest a great deal about democracy and human rights and so on. So in Iran today, when we want to talk about it, we certainly in a broader sense can talk about conservatives and radicals or militants. But there are so many variations of this. For example, one thinker that is considered to be leading, some call him a philosopher, religious thinker, but a lay person, is called Abdul Karim Surush. Now, Abdul Karim Surush's essence of message is that religion is one thing in terms of its fundamental and tenets. And the interpretation, the knowledge of religion is something else. And therefore, a lot of these jurisprudence in Islam are the interpretations of mortal human beings. And they will change with the change of time and circumstances. That's his message, in a general sense. Then there are others. A cleric like Montazeri, who was supposed to succeed Khomeini as a dissident cleric, who believes that the clerics should be separated from state power. It's another example. Another cleric like Kadiver, Mohsen Kadiver, believing that the way the regime has developed is some kind of a sultanism, some kind of a monarchy, religious monarchy or religious autocracy. And then there are women's role in this religious thinking. In Persian, say, no andisheye dini, which means new religious thinking. New religious thinking. And there are women leaders, like Shirin Ebadi, who became Pulitzer Prize winner as an Iranian woman. Lawyer, and I believe she's also involved in defending Ruzbeh Ebrahimi. So here we have such variations. There are also those who really are secularist, who just simply believe that there should be, in our terminology, something like Mr. Jefferson's wall of separation, which itself is debated in this culture as to whether or not the wall was that absolute, but let's not get into that. But the point is that they would want to see complete separation of, in our terminology, church and state or religion and state. Now, having said all this, I have a tiny message. Please let us not oversimplify Iran regime, Iranian culture. I was really disappointed to see Under Secretary Byrne talks about Iran as Ahmadinejad regime. That is a conflating of a country, a culture, a history with all its dynamics and complexity in terms of a one man who is obviously in our media and otherwise demonized, and certainly demonized by people in his own country. But he doesn't represent Iran or what is really going on in Iran. What is exciting about it is this new generation of Iranian thinkers such as Parespikian, a realist speaker. And that is the younger generation, journalists, bloggers, writers, thinkers, who really, however you label them as reformists or secularists or whatever, it doesn't matter, the label doesn't matter, but they are in the forefront, and that I should emphasize, especially in the presence of Professor Milani, the role of women in this new thinking in Iran is extremely important. And by all Middle East standards, I assure you, Iran is the only country in which the overwhelming majority of the people are essentially pro-democracy, where you have a kind of an oasis in the middle of the desert of anti-Americanism, and they are not anti-American. And we'd never get that kind of a picture in our media. So this is the hope of Iran. And no outside interference will ever help it. How much more time I have, George?
As much as you would like.
Okay. But let me just tell you. We always think about all these dynamics within a society. And we should, in terms of politics, culture, etc. Changes, resistance to change, etc. But sometimes we forget that in studying international relations, you cannot simply take a domestic situation and from it read foreign policy of a country. You can't do that in Iran. And why of it is obvious, particularly in this global age. Because what is said about the country, what is done about the country, affects the internal dynamics. Are we the same kind of a society we were before 9/11? 9/11 wasn't anything domestic about America. It came from the outside. But look what it has done. Those of us who now are concerned about our civil liberties, what national security is doing to our civil liberty. So the foreign element. Now in Iran, I want to say to you, there has never been an internal development devoid of foreign element. The Iranians, for the first time, tried to have a representative government in 1906, it's about the 100th anniversary of what was called Constitutional Revolution. What happened to it? Britain and Russia, for imperial interest, for the fear of Germany, intervened, and that even the parliament building was bombarded by the Russian Cossacks and Russian soldiers. That was the first experience. The second experience, I was witness to that. A popular democratic election took place in Iran. and a gentleman called Dr. Mohammad Mosaddegh was elected. What happened to it? What happened to him? Was there domestic dynamics that put an end to his premiership? No. It was CIA that meant the end of Mossadegh. And thirdly, let's come to Ahmadinejad. I believe that there are all kinds of reasons why Ahmadinejad became the president of Iran. It was a surprise to many. But let me say what I think. I think we should not exclude the external element. The night before the election, the president of the United States, for all practical purposes, denounced the Iranian electoral system. Those who were in Iran, I wasn't, but I have enough reports, united, left, right, conservative, liberal, whatever you call, they all got united against the external enemy, which was then considered Mr. Bush. Against the background that Iran had helped with the deposition of the Taliban in Afghanistan, I was involved in part of this in the sense that US and Iran cooperated in putting an end to that regime and also installing in power Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan. But soon thereafter, the president of the United States called Iran part of the axis of evil. The impact of that in Iran, again, was uniting right and left and conservative and so on. So this time, I hope we have learned from 100 years of history that we can encourage such movements, reformists, and so on. But in a Jeffersonian sense, if I may, I came to a conclusion in my own research that if I had asked Mr. Jefferson, how do you export democracy? And don't forget, Jefferson was all for the spread of liberty around the world as a hope. And he would want to see the spread of democracy, one, by America's own example, and two, through education. That was my conclusion. And here we have a very important lesson. Aid to education, programs we used to have like Fulbright, diminished really, and others like it, Peace Corps volunteers, etc. and so on. Those are the real shakers and movers if you're trying to think about regime change. Regime change, to be authentic, to be durable, would have to spring from our own society, from a country's own people and culture and history. Thanks. Well, I have the honor to introduce our real speaker, which is Mr. Rusbeh Mir Ebrahimi. Very briefly, he has given me just a few lines about himself, which is part of his extreme modesty. Rusbeh is only 28 years old, which means he's really the son of the revolution. He is the son of the revolution, because the revolution has been 28 years in existence. He has worked for his degree, university, free university, in the political science field. But there is a kind of a political science field which is not just a study, but going beyond study. Is that right? Practitioners of politics. He has been in newspaper writings, blogging, and so on, numerous newspapers in Iran for about 9 years. And he has written, of course, I don't need to mention the name of the newspapers, they may not mean anything to you, but some of the reformist newspapers, he has been a contributor to them, indeed, apart from his own blogger efforts. So much for the more interesting, pleasant type. In year 2004, there was a dossier of a file made of blockers. Those are or blockers, writers, or whatever you call them. And he was detained, arrested, and he was in solitary confinement for 60 days. And I had a little taste of that with George. I ask you, what was that solitary confinement like? The space was enough for him to lie down on the ground. No pillow, no blanket, no nothing. No real light, no real communication with the outside world, and constant interrogations that sometimes would take place from about, 8 o'clock in the morning till?
1 o'clock.
At night? 1 o'clock, 1 a.m. He was beaten. He told me that he wasn't lashed. Maybe that was very generous. But he was beaten. His head on the wall, on the table, in any way possible. The psychological pressure was obviously enormous in that solitary confinement. At the present time, his case is before the Iranian courts. And he has been charged with, I believe, 8 different charges. I got a few out of him. One, that his writings, speaking and so on and so forth, have been contrary to quote-unquote national security interests of Iran. That's one charge. Another charge, that he has spread falsehood by what he has written or said or done. And he has been the creator of illegal groups in the country. And he has participated in demonstrations which, from the regime's perspective, are illegal. Now, these charges are to be looked at by the courts. And as I mentioned before, one of the lawyers involved in Ruzbe's case is Shirin Ebadi, again, the well-known Iranian woman lawyer. and in 2006, they, I'm sure you are aware of the Human Rights Watch, together with six other Iranians, he got a prize for what he has done and what he has said and what he has written of the Helmut Hammett Prize. And میخوای بگی من چی این هلمت همت که برای اینا بگم؟
هلمت همت یک جایزه که دیدبان حقوق بشر سالانه به نویسندگانی که توی کشورشون مورد سانسور قرار میگیرن میده در کل جهان.
That prize is for those who are essentially dissident writers and thinkers within their own country. And it's the recognition of their role. And that is a very brief, really. He wanted it to be brief. a description of his background. And I'm sure if there are questions related to that, will be answered. Thank you.
I'm delighted to be playing the part of this brave young Iranian for the next half a dozen minutes. His remarks are as follows. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to have this opportunity to be with you today. I speak as an Iranian journalist during the reformist period. The profession of journalism has played a major role in the transformation of the Iranian society and the development of a civil society there. It has also paid dearly for its activities. Newspapers have been shut down, journalists have repeatedly been arrested, persecuted, and even faced death. Nevertheless, journalists continue to take advantage of any slight opening to inform the people and to reach the public. One could speak and write volumes about the struggle that journalists face in Iran, but here I will briefly try to portray a glimpse of what horrendous difficulties a journalist encounters. Publication of newspapers in Iran has a long and tumultuous history. The single most important mission of journalism is informing the general public. The main function, therefore, is to aid the progress of social and cultural change. This function, in part, involves speaking truth to power. Small wonder, then, if the press is considered the fourth pillar of democracy. From the reformist period to the present, in the name of the law, the regime has committed illegal acts against the press. The triumph of the reformist government of Syed Mohammed Khatami in 1997 witnessed the founding of new publications. It marked the beginning of the flourishing of a free press. But the power elite sensed that a well-informed citizenry was a real threat to its hold on power. It did its best to suppress it. During this period, the press was constrained and further limited through overt and covert mechanisms. In its overt form, one single speech and the labeling of the press as the base of the enemy led to the closing down of tens of publications in less than a week. Censorship became more and more apparent to the public. During this same period, thousands of journalists were forced out of work while some others were locked up. Notably, prior to this, the fifth legislative session, which was dominated by reactionary deputies, had enacted laws which limited freedom of the press in clear contravention of the Constitution. Even the sixth legislative session, which was dominated by reformist representatives, failed to overturn the law against the freedom of the press. The direct intervention of the supreme leader added this oppressive law to other laws considered sacred. The amended law in the fifth legislative session became a means to impose censorship. The other implications of press suppression and imposed censorship was even more distressing. Once the regime closed down newspapers and incarcerated journalists, it came up with a novel idea to eradicate the flourishing awareness of the public. The power elite began to create distance between the people and the press. Resentful of the hard-won trust between the press and its interlocutors, the regime did its utmost to weaken this bond. The question is, how was this accomplished? Here are the ways through which press censorship is enacted in Iran today. The powerful and conservative Council of Guardians started on the path of censorship during the middle of President Khatami's first term and reached its peak subsequently. The primary function of the Council under the Constitution is to ensure that acts of legislation are not incompatible with Islamic tenets and the Articles of the Constitution, but in effect, the Council has become the major instrument of press suppression. Regularly, and in some cases on a weekly basis, the Council of Guardians approve new legislations which were communicated furtively to the press. If these amendments were to be collected in a volume, it would make a masterpiece of satire. Unfortunately, this boundless power was bestowed upon the Council of Guardians by the fifth legislative session. Instead of protecting the interests of the public against illegal encroachments, the prosecutor general, in effect, has become prosecutor particular, in the sense that instead of protecting the public, it patently sides with the power establishment. Instead of siding with the people and protecting the press, which serve as the watchdog of the people, the prosecutor general has regularly sided with the power elite and interpreted the law subjectively. This institution, with the help of the Revolutionary Guard, security agencies, and the state-run television, has caused the arrest and imprisonment of many journalists. It is necessary to mention that the hardline government of Ahmadinejad has outdone the judiciary in its anti-press activities. During these years, the editorial boards of newspapers and journals were transformed into major agents of censorship. Clearly, this was in response to new developments as well as a strategy. The constant threat of indictment by the prosecutor general was similar to taking the editors hostage. In addition, the policy of surviving at whatever price immersed the press in self-censorship. Obviously, there were those editors who set public interest above private gains and emerged triumphant. Not a few journalists have succumbed to the temptation of self-censorship out of fear of arrest and imprisonment on the one hand and job insecurity on the other. Nevertheless, there are those journalists who continue against all odds to respond to the people's demand for a free press. The majority of the journalists who are the product of the short interlude of the freedom of the press are doing their best to resist the regime's desire to silence them. That is why it can be claimed that choosing journalism as a profession in Iran is not like walking in a minefield, it is like stepping on a mine. In light of my brief personal account as an Iranian journalist, I have to emphasize that many journalists in Iran continue to struggle against press suppression. The rise of a new generation of journalists promises to increase journalists' self-awareness and contribute to the growing public knowledge about freedom in all its manifestations, including that of freedom of the press. I hope that every politically aware Iranian will find his or her path to freedom in a constructive manner. Thank you. Did I read it all right?
Beautiful.
I'm going to move to the back of the room, the back corner there, and I would invite those who have questions to join me in the back, and Ruzba will be delighted to answer the questions. I would like to start off with a question about the opposition of the clerics to modernity. Iran, in many respects, is a very modern country with tall buildings, major industry, the capability now, we understand it, of generating nuclear power, manufacture two different kinds of automobiles, and are almost half the people are involved in non-agricultural pursuits. So what aspects of modernity is it that the clerical government, the conservative government, opposes? Let me suggest, too, so that our listeners can hear the beautiful Persian being spoken. that you pull the the microphones close.
I was going to talk to him in English. اون عواملی که ملاها به اصطلاح خیلی برزدشن چی هست؟ برای اینکه ایران از لحاظ صنعت و فلان و فلان و فلان پیش رفته است، یه مدرنه به اصطلاح، ولی اونایی که این ریلیجیس استبلیشمنت آر اگینست، اونایی که ریلیجیس استبلیشمنت مخالفت دارن چی ها؟ چه عواملی است در به اصطلاح تضاد با اونها؟
بیشتر میخوان راجع به تجدد ستیزی صحبت بکنید. گفتن که در ایران ساختمان‌های بلند هست،
نمادهای مدرنیته هست.
بله دقیقا. بنابراین فکر میکنید دلیل تجدد ستیزی در ایران چیست؟ خودتون به انگلیسی میتونید بگید؟
نه اونقدر دیگه نمیتونم. من اول سلام کنم و بگم خوشحالم که اینجا هستم.
He's happy to be here and gives you his greetings.
در مورد سوالم اینو میتونم بگم که کلن حکومت ایران و روحانیت در ایران بخش وسیعش ضد تجددن.
The answer to the question is that the opposition of the clerics is against modernity, in essence.
در طول تاریخ حداقل 100 سال هم نگاه بکنید، معمولا یک جنگ و جدلی بین روشنفکران و تجدد طلبان با روحانیت و مذهبیون بوده همیشه.
If you look back, I mentioned something about it in my remarks, that over the past 100 years, if we look at it, we still see the same kind of a pattern of the clerical, not all the clerics, but clerical opposition in general to those who are considered modernist and the process of modernization. Rose.
اما خب همه کسایی که تو حکومت هستن، همه کسایی که تو حکومت هستن هم دقیقا میدونن که بدون ابزار تکنولوژیک و به اصطلاح به دست آوردن نمادهای تجدد و مدرنیته نمیتونن کشور را اداره بکنن و تو به اصطلاح به یک نوع توسعه و رفاه در کشور به وجود بیارن.
At the same time, the regime is well aware of the uses of modern technology and modern instruments of power to keep itself in power, and yet in respect to such things, if I may add, as freedom of the press and freedom of assembly or demonstrations and so on, those things could cause or pose some kind of a threat to the power elite in Iran.
اما خب جمهوری اسلامی، اصلا حکومت جمهوری اسلامی به یک نوع میخواد انتخاب بکنه، یعنی میخواد تجدد رو بعضی جنبه‌هاش رو بگیره و بعضی جنبه‌هاش رو به اصطلاح نگیره، و همین باعث شده دچار یک بحرانی بشه، چون به حال تجدد وقتی نمادهاش میاد، فرهنگش هم میاد، مطالباتش هم میاد، اینا یک تناقضاتی در سیستم وجود آورده.
Because of the exploitation of certain instruments of modernity, technology, and so on, there is a definite rift within the society, and if I may add, even within the establishment itself, that is created because of this tension. Because essentially, the regime is selective in its being pro-modern and anti-modern at the same time.
و تقریبا تا حدود زیادی این چند دهه اخیر باعث شده همون جوری که نمادهای مدرنیته وارد ایران شده، به لحاظ فرهنگی مطالبات مدرن هم مطرح شده و خواسته های جدیدی از حکومت مطرح میشه که حکومت به یک نوع به این تناقضات برخورده. اما حکومت با یک چیز مشکل داره و اونم آگاهیه و مشکل اصلی اینه که حکومت میگه از ابزارهای مدرن وقتی مدرنیته بالا بره سطح مطالبات بالا میره و آگاهی بالا میره. مشکل حکومت با مدرنیته اینه، نه چیز دیگه.
The real fear of the regime is political awareness, knowledge, the growth, intellectual and otherwise, of the society at large. That is a real threat that they perceive. That the better informed people, the more dangerous they are. That's in essence. Once I was in Iran a number of years ago, I had not been there for a very, very long time. And I was asked, what do you think of what is going on in Iran? I put a label in English, I would say, epistemic revolution. That is a tremendous flourishing of knowledge, whether through translations, writings, and all kinds of things. And these are the real threats to the regime.
بس بخوایم خلاصه کنیم بگیم چی روحانیت، حکومت روحانیون با چی مشکل داره، دقیقاً با همینجا. یعنی تا جایی که شهروندان آگاه داشته باشه و شهروندان حق خودشونو طلب بکنن، اینجا خط قرمز نظام جمهوری اسلامیه. تا با بقیه به اصطلاح تجدد مشکلی نداره چون از اونها استفاده میکنه. اینجاست که مشکل، چون به پایه های خود رژیم میخوره، میاد و جلوش ایستادگی میکنه.
His emphasis on that the threat that the regime feels is that when the people are better informed, they are better aware of their, in our language, their rights, and they make demands on the regime, and all those are unpalatable to the regime.
اما این نکته رو باید بگیم که در سیستم جمهوری اسلامی و جامعه مذهبی ایران و نخبگان مذهبی همه تجدد ستیز نیستن و خوشبختانه در پایگاه اصلی خود حکومت که حوزه‌های علمی هم هست، ما روحانیون می‌بینیم که تلاش دارن تجدد رو با اسلام بیامیزند و مشکلی پیش نیاد.
Another important emphasis in our terminology, we shouldn't think about all the clerics as kind of a monolithic whole. That they are clerics who are very enlightened and also try to see some kind of a compatibility between modernity and tradition.
I stand corrected.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. I must commend you on your bravery in you. Pursuing your profession, and your comments regarding conditions in Iran were extremely enlightening. Could you compare, or perhaps you would have some additional information regarding repression of the press and particularly the blogging activities in neighboring countries in the Middle East, in other Islamic nations, and how would this compare with conditions in Iran?
خیلی گفتن شما رو تقدیر میکنم برای شهامتی که دارید و همه ما خیلی مستفیض شدیم از سخنرانی بسیار جالب و دقیق شما. از شما خواهش کردم که در مورد بلاگر های ایران در مقایسه با ممالک دیگر اسلامی و بخصوص همسایه های ایران صحبت بکنید.
اولین نکته که باید به عنوان یک نکته مثبت در جامعه ایرانی باید بهش تاکید کرد و خوشحال بود، همین بحث استقبالی که از اینترنت شده و طبق آخرین آمار ایران در خاورمیانه بیشترین کاربر اینترنتی داره که 7.5 میلیون کاربر اینترنتی داره. این خودش یک گام مثبته.
The first thing I would like to talk about is the incredible popularity of usage of internet in Iran. Currently, there are more than 7.5 million users of the internet in Iran.
این فاصله به حدی که عربستان که کشور شماره دو در منطقه هستش یک میلیون و صد هزار نفر کاربر داره، یعنی یه فاصله 6 میلیونی بین کاربران ایران و نفر کشور دوم وجود داره.
The second country in the Middle East in terms of usage of the internet is Saudi Arabia, and there are 1.1 million users of internet in Saudi Arabia, and you see that there is a difference of almost 6 million people between the users of the internet in Iran and those who use it in Saudi Arabia.
اینجا اهمیت اینترنت به این دلیل خیلی زیاده که فضای انحصاری رسانه‌ای در داخل ایران رو شکسته این اینترنت.
The importance of this usage of the internet is that it has broken the monopoly on information.
و در کنار همین توسعه اینترنت ما میتونیم گسترش وبلاگ‌های فارسی در ایران رو بهش تاکید بکنیم که طبق آخرین آمار چهارمین کشور در سطح جهانند وبلاگ‌های فارسی.
We can also talk about the numbers of web bloggers in Iran. It seems that at this point Iran is the fourth country in the world when it comes to web blogging.
این هم از اون جهت اهمیت داره که به یک نوع اون فضای تک‌صدایی رسانه‌ای رو شکسته، چون الان وبلاگ‌ها کم کم دارن تبدیل به نقش رسانه‌ای پیدا می‌کنن که خودشون یک روزنامه‌های تک نویسنده و تک تحریری هستن.
Like anywhere else in the world, the importance of these webloggers is that they have broken the monopoly on the news. And each of these webloggers have become, in a way, an interpreter and a relayer of the news.
و ما بتونیم اگه بخوایم یه آماری بگیریم، دقیقاً میزان گسترش وبلاگ‌ها با میزان سانسور و محدودیت در ایران یک حالت تساوی داره. یعنی هر چقدر سانسور در ایران بیشتر شد در مطبوعات، وبلاگ‌ها گسترش بیشتری پیدا کردن.
Paradoxically, as censorship has increased in Iran, the number of web bloggers has also increased.
و بخش وسیع از روزنامه‌نگارانی که با محدودیت در فضای کار روزنامه‌ای مواجه می‌شدند به سمت وبلاگ‌ها گرایش پیدا کردند و الان در ایران وبلاگ‌های روزنامه‌نگارها از روزنامه‌ها تأثیرگذار به خاطر انتشار اخباری که انجام می‌دن. که روزنامه‌ها نمیتونن این کار انجام بدن.
And a number of journalists who were censored have resorted to web blogging, and it's interesting that nowadays many journalists have resorted to web blogs to communicate with their readership.
از این جهت هم شاید بشه ایران رو جز معدود کشورهای دنیا حساب کرد که بلاگرهاشون خیلی نزدیکم به لحاظ محتوای کار به روزنامه‌نگاری نیست، ولی به لحاظ در بقیه جا وبلاگ یک چیز سرگرمی، یک چیز شخصیه که به اصطلاح اونقدر اهمیتی که در ایران داره نداره، ولی در ایران به دلیل همون سانسوری که بوده نقش رسانه‌ای پیدا کرده و با ادبیات روزنامه‌نگاری داره بلاگ‌ها گسترش پیدا می‌کنه.
It is interesting to note that web bloggers in Iran, unlike anywhere else in the world, have become almost like journalism. They are more politicized, and unlike other places where weblogs are more subjective, in Iran, webloggers are quite closely interested in issues of politics and discuss what journalists couldn't do previously or cannot do currently because of censorship laws.
دقیقاً الان یکی از موزل‌های اصلی جمهوری اسلامی برای جلوگیری از اطلاع رسانی و بالا بردن آگاهی‌های مردم وبلاگ‌ها هستند. روزنامه‌ها به اطلاع به اون چیزی که من در این صحبت‌هام گفتم، روزنامه‌ها تقریباً خنسا شدن. یعنی روزنامه‌ها یک روزنامه‌های تقریباً در حداقل فضای موجود دارن منتشر میشن، ولی بلاگ ها هستن که مشکل اصلی جمهوری اسلامی هستن و انواع و اقسام حربه های فیلترینگ و بازداشت و زندان هم متوسل شدن که بتونن این بحث رو، یعنی وبلاگ ها رو خنثا بکنن که هنوز نتونستن این کار انجام بدن.
Remarkably, web bloggers have become major opponents of the Islamic Republic, and the government, the regime, has been completely neutralized in its dealing with web bloggers. Journalists have been, in a way, neutralized because of censorship laws, but the regime has not been able to deal with web bloggers, and that's why Mr. Ruzbeh believes that currently web bloggers at times are more, are considered more like the enemy than the journalists who have been neutralized because of various censorship laws and impositions on their freedom of expression.
Beautiful. بخشی از این محبوبیت و گسترش وبلاگ ها رو بنده اعتقاد دارم مدیون جمهوری اسلامی هستیم، به خاطر اینکه با دستگیری ها و پرونده سازی که انجام شد باعث شد وبلاگ ها گسترش بیشتری پیدا کنند و تقریبا بعد از تهدید وبلاگ نویسان بود که یه وبلاگ ها رشد تقریبا در یک سال یک رشد 3-4 میلیونی داشتن. یعنی هر چیزی که جمهوری اسلامی میره به سمت بستنش اون بیشتر گسترش پیدا میکنه. وبلاگ ها هم از این اشتباه جمهوری اسلامی بی بهره نبودن که خب به سود یه بحث دیگه شد، بحث آزادی بیان در ایران شد.
It's ironic but nonetheless true that with the imposition of these restrictions on web bloggers, in fact web blogging became more popular in Iran. And suddenly, in the course of a few months, we have more than 3 to 4 million more webloggers. People who resort to this means of communication to talk to their compatriots.
الان اینقدر مهم شده که آقای احمدی نژاد هم وبلاگ داره.
Even Mr. Ahmadinejad, the president, has his own weblog now. He too had to resort to this means of communication.
Time for two more questions.
You may have spoken to this in passing. You say in your paper that there are brave reporters still in Iran, and given the repressive regime, are there the two versions of this question. Are there underground newspapers that circulate? I assume that the official newspapers don't get much truth. And two, is there much of an internet and blogging in Iran?
من توی صحبتتون اشاره کردید که هنوز در ایران روزنامه نگارایی هستن که کارایی میکنن که خلاف رژیم کار زیرزمینی میکنن. آیا هنوز مثلا مجله هایی هست که زیرزمینی هست و آیا هنوز وبلاگرای زیادی در ایران هست؟ جواب دومی رو که دادید ولی فکر میکنم مجددم باید اشاره بکنید.
وبلاگ که در ایران میام گسترش پیدا کرده و وبلاگ نویسان بیشتری هم هستند. در مورد بخش اولش
اجازه بدید اینو ترجمه کنم. As for your first second question, the issue of weblogging, as I mentioned, Iran now has the largest number of webloggers in the Middle East. I believe he had said that there are 7.5 million webloggers in Iran. It's the number one country in the whole Middle East.
اما در مورد روزنامه نگاری بگم، گفتم روزنامه نگاری حساب کنید توی این مطلب من گفتم با 400 سانسور مواجه میشه. یعنی الان چیزی که در ایران داره در میاد از حداقل فضای موجود برای گفتن حرف ها استفاده میشه که به نظر من یکی از بزرگترین هنر روزنامه نگاران الان در ایران اینه که از حداقل فضاها سعی میکنن حرفاشون رو بزنن به اصطلاح، و باید به نظر من ازشون تقدیر کرد، چون واقعا کار کردن در اون شرایط خیلی سخت‌تر از کار کردن در شرایط آزاده. و هنر رو الان اونا دارن در ایران انجام میدن.
When it comes to the issue of censorship and journalism in Iran, as I mentioned it in my presentation, there are four different instruments of censorship currently imposed on journalists in Iran. I believe he had referred to the censorship imposed by the Council of Guardians, censorship through the Office of the Prosecutor General, censorship through editorial boards, and self-censorship imposed on the self by journalists. But Ruzbev would like to emphasize that in spite of these various forms of censorship, there are still many journalists who use the slightest openings to communicate with people and to share with them their views.
We are grateful for Dr. Milani and Dr. Ramazani's, wonderful setting of the context and provision of historical background, and Dr. Milani's elegance in her translation of the text, and working with Dr. Ramazani. We are, I think all of us in this room, mindful of the fact that many of the great things that have happened in converting oppressive regimes to democracies have occurred as the result of the activities of young people. Jefferson was in his 20s when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. And we are aware of the valor of the young people in the civil rights revolution in this country and in other activities. So it's a special treat to have a young man from Iran who is indeed brave and has put his own life on the line in the cause of freedom of expression. Please join me in thanking Ruzbah Mirabrahini.